Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes, copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes, and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author was talking about the air in her yard, where it comes from, and what it smells like. We resume Suburban Safari on page 171, and this is episode 17. Investigating the smell of the ocean, I find that I'm inhaling a myriad of chemicals. The wind blows salt crystals off the sea surface and into the air. Seaweeds exhale methyl iodide, which may combat infection for them as it does for us. They also contribute fragrant methyl bromide and methyl chloride to the sea breeze. Algae egg cells release sex pheromones into the water to help algae sperm cells locate them, and one of those pheromones smells just like tomato leaves. But what causes the watermelon smell? I follow my nose to Philip Kraft, who dreams up molecules for the fragrance powerhouse Givaudan in Switzerland. The watermelon scent of the ocean is, to me, still a mystery, he emails in reply. He thinks it might be a combination of algae pheromones and ozone. If he knew what it was, he'd bottle it. He has experimented with combining melon and ozone notes to reproduce ocean, but success is evasive. When the cold weather comes, the ocean smell fades. Many odor sources chill out in the winter. Evaporation of smelly liquids slows as the hemisphere cools. Deciduous plants, who churned out sweet jasminate and grassy hexanols in summer, die and desist. The sweet evergreens squelch their metabolism. Molds go still, and yeast that converts fallen fruit into a vapor of airborne wine contract into dormancy. The off-gassing carcass of a mouse or a seagull slows, then halts in mid-decomposition. This is one of the ways the air announces a change of season. It carries less. Furthermore, even those smellies that don't freeze have a hard time getting around. Smell travels best in moist air, but cold air is usually dry, so when the winter wind blows into my yard, it brings little to stimulate the nose. It's that absence of odor, that cold emptiness, that smells like winter. Winter comes straight out of the north, bearing nothing but clear sunlight. A front blusters through at midday, rolling garbage cans, whipping the raspberry canes, and snapping twigs off the apple trees. A neighbor's ailing maple loses half its leaves. Widespread frost is forecast for overnight, and a radio weatherman urges listeners to pick the last zucchini. Suburban air carries its signature smells. It also conveys an abnormal quantity of light. The nightly bloom of photons saves me from tripping on cracks in the sidewalk and illuminates the boogeyman in the bushes, but it disorients other creatures. On a cold, still night in the fall, I hear the night migrants slicing through the air. My mother is visiting, and it is she who picks out the sound from the background hum of street lights, distant traffic, sighing pine needles, ticking oak leaves, dryer vents, humming plumbing, 100 muted television programs, and 100 more conversations. I'm sorry to say I don't think I would have, although now I'm probably destined to live for it every autumn night for the rest of my life. Watch the moon, Mom says. You might see one crossing. But the sound is ethereal enough for me. The avian voices form an invisible lace that stretches across the blackness. Two, two, two. If a blind person wants to sense the allure of meteor showers, she could listen to the night migrants. The disembodied rain of bird calls is eerie and lovely. Blinded myself by the darkness, I can only imagine the tiny bodies hurtling south between heaven and earth. Mixed with the too-too is an occasional twack and cheep in a lower register. The high ones may be warblers, but I really can't say, admits Mom, who normally knows birds by their song. They all have completely different calls for migrating. The wide river of birds flows on and on. Down below them, our earthbound bodies grow cold. When I go to bed, I leave a window open a crack and lie awake listening. Too, too, such a long night lies ahead of them. My first thought is that the songbirds are migrating at night to avoid predatory hawks, but that turns out to be a minor consideration. A better reason is that they've got to eat, and they can't catch bugs at night, so they pack on the fat during daylight, then make headway at night. There are other reasons, too. All that flapping raises a bird's temperature, which can be dangerous. To cool off, they have to evaporate water from the air sacs in their respiratory system. As with sweating marathoners, that causes dehydration. Flying during the coldest hours reduces their need for cooling. And lastly, birds get better mileage per calorie after sunlight. Cold air is less turbulent and more dense than sun-warmed air. Just like airplanes, birds are most efficient when they're slicing through a smooth, dense atmosphere. Night migrants pay a modern toll on their night travel, however. Light pollution is such a recent obstacle that birds haven't adapted to it. One banner night in Kansas, for instance, between 5,000 and 10,000 Lapland longspurs fell at the foot of a 420-foot tower. The annual tower toll for the entire United States is between 4 million and 40 million birds. Scientists, intrigued by the piles of songbirds who die around lighted office buildings and communication towers on migration nights, have tried to understand what's going wrong. The studies indicate that the birds aren't attracted to a lighted tower, per se. Rather, if they fly into its cloud of diffuse light on a foggy or overcast night, their little brains short-circuit. They simply will not leave the circle of light. They flap, flutter, hover, and circle until they smash into an unlighted guy wire or a fellow bird, or drop from exhaustion. Scientists have experimented with turning off the lights when birds are in this holding pattern. The bird brains sort themselves out and fly away. Cities and suburbs are aglow with these fatal attractions. I often walk with a neighbor and her dog in a park that holds a cell phone tower. Why no pile of birds, I wonder? One reason could be that scavengers, coons, cats, rats, and other vermin, have learned that the tower bases make excellent eateries and they swallow the evidence of the massacre. Another reason is that a stream of migrants is only likely to flow into a light trap when clouds or fog obscure their view of the stars, so some nights are safer than others. I do find a bright spot, or a dark spot, really, in my research. A lights-out campaign in Chicago seems to be reducing the carnage around office buildings whose managers darken them at night. Anecdotal evidence of success includes a report from one building's maintenance crew who no longer have to shovel piles of dead birds from their roof after a heavy migration night. Birders who walk in the downtown area also say they're counting fewer dead carcasses on the sidewalk. A similar effort in Toronto not only lobbies for darkened buildings, but also mobilizes volunteers to collect the thousands of downed birds. They've found that 1 in 3 survives its fascination with the light and can be released. The streetlights in my neighborhood are less hazardous to high-flying birds. They're more likely to mess with my own vision. And to tell the truth, city lights don't blind people to the curiosities of the cosmos nearly as effectively as does a failure to look up. When the stars fall from the sky on a hard frozen November night, all the stray photons of Portland and South Portland can't combine to drown out the show. Wrapped in my granddad's fake alpaca coat, I take a chair on the deck at 3 a.m. Gray clouds of my breath drift against a black velvet sky. Whiss! A fireball streaks over neighbor Hugh's house. Whiss! Another follows it. From the corner of my eye, I spot one over the south neighbor's roof. Whiss! A long one. They don't make a sound, but they should. They're so sudden, so glaring. And some people do report that meteorites make hissing or crackling sounds. But not I, not tonight. Like alien visitors, these fireballs defy local custom and self-destruct in silence. They are alien visitors. Meteorites are bits of sand and pebbles shed by a comet and left in Earth's path. As our orbiting planet plows into them, they burn in our atmosphere. Left in the air is a puff of comet smoke. If just the outer layers scorch away, the core of the micrometeorite may drop into my frosted grass. This happens with a regularity that I find stunning. Every square meter of the planet receives one speck of space dust each day, on average. Statistically, my yard ought to gain upward of 100 space dust motes per day. In the dark, with my head tilted back, I open my mouth hoping something celestial might fall in. Whiss, whiss, twin fires streak over the rooftops. Even in these wee hours, my neighborhood is bright. The fire barn is washed with blue floodlight. Porch lights blaze yellow. A string of peach streetlights marches down each avenue. To the northwest, the dirty glow of downtown Portland bulges above the trees. And still I can see the shooting stars, perhaps one every 10 seconds. On other nights, cupping my eyes to block this street light and that bright bathroom window, I've seen the northern lights flickering in rose and neon green. That said, while I'm seeing 6 shooting stars a minute, Mom, back in her country house, watches a blizzard of burning hailstones over her hayfield. While I watch a shower, she sees a storm. I comfort myself with the notion that the city lights are filtering out all the weak and unfit meteorites from my view. Only the brightest pebbles show in the suburbs. The fuzz of urban light does erase the night's fainter lights. I wouldn't want to have to count the moons of Jupiter from my backyard, but in my experience, the moon of Earth and a few stars are visible from nearly any place on the planet. I've seen celestial wonders from cities all over the world, so I'm hooked, just as I'll cock my ear to hear the night migrants for the rest of my life. I'm also compelled to check the sky every night, even from the heart of the world's brightest cities, to census the stars. Maybe the reason I hear no meteor whistling is that urban air thrums with excess sound. When friends from the urban core come to visit, they stand in the yard and look around. It's so quiet, they marvel. Then one of the neighbors fires up a lawnmower. What I hear is partly a matter of what I tune in. When I lived in New York City, English sparrows were forever nattering in the fence, the shrubs, and the ginkgo trees. But for my ear to strain their calls from the rumble and bleat of traffic required concentration. And as with the fainter stars, some sounds are simply out of reach in the city. I remember watching Canada geese V over my brownstone in the fall. I strained the muscles of my cochlea and heard nothing but human din. Here the geese honk into hearing before they flap into sight. Sometimes they've just risen from a nearby pond and are jockeying into position. Bits of V form, break loose, and reform. Other times the V is high and precise and set on a course that will take the geese south over the ocean to Cape Cod. As with light pollution, noise presents animals with a newfangled challenge. Birds especially rely on their voices to stake out a territory and attract a mate. Automobile traffic penetrates more bird territory every year. One bird, at least, has found a way to make himself heard above the roar. Dutch scientists set about recording male great tits singing near busy streets and in quiet neighborhoods. When they analyzed the pitch at which the chickadee-like birds sang, they discovered that street-side birds were tightening their strings, so to speak. They sing higher, to be heard over the bass roar of cars. Averaged over many individual birds, it's the equivalent of stepping from a white piano key up to a black one. Our human landscapes change fast, faster than most animals can evolve, so an animal with flexibility built into his character is the one most likely to succeed in adapting to the changes in the air. Climate change, though, is going to test the stretch of even the most pliant animals and plants. Climate change is nothing new. It's a constant on this planet. Sudden climate change is par for the course, too. Even a climate shift that coincides with a plague of extinctions is precedented. What's new about this upward bounce of the mercury is that we're causing it. The hardships confronting plants and animals are attributable to my Toyota and my electric oven. A second novelty in this climate wobble is that we know our planet mates well enough to feel regret for the trials they'll face. Different backyards are presenting different trials, which is why scientists use the term global climate change, not global warming. Northwest of my yard, the core of Canada has already warmed by 7 or 8 degrees, but eastern Canada and the maritime provinces have cooled at a comparable rate. Here in Maine, the winter nights are warmer. Ice storms are replacing snowstorms, and the snowpack is melting 1 or 2 weeks earlier in springtime. Local sugar maples aren't getting the frosty spring nights they're accustomed to, so the maple syrup industry is moving north. The ocean downhill from my yard has heated 6 degrees in a century. All these changes favor mobile and adaptable species and pose a challenge to those who need a specific habitat or a particular food in order to reproduce. Besides crows and squirrels, the survivors include a suite of aggressive invaders from other ecosystems. In my youth, deer ticks were unheard of around here. Now they're pressing deeper into the state every year. The milder winters are killing fewer mosquitoes. While that's good news for skeeter-eating bats and birds, it's not propitious for birds who are vulnerable to the West Nile virus. The warming ocean may not kill crustaceans outright, but a depressing reality is that warm water makes bland lobsters. Some animals will fade out, some will adapt. Migratory birds seem to be adjusting to an earlier spring. Nearly every species that migrates through Helgoland's island north of the Dutch coast now arrives earlier than 4 decades ago. Some come almost 2 weeks earlier. Similar early bird patterns are showing up elsewhere, too. Whether the migrants are heading south later this autumn than they used to has received less attention from scientists. The night I heard the songbirds tooing through the blackness, I noted the date. Next fall, maybe I'll be lucky enough to catch their voices ringing through the ether again, and I'll check the calendar to see if they stayed longer or shorter. Generally, it takes many years to accumulate a reliable quantity of data, but you have to start somewhere. And really, it's just an excuse. When winter is filtering into the air and it's cozy indoors, the possibility of catching the night migrants will be a reminder to step outside and take the air. Section 4, Winter. Chapter 10, The 13 Coldest Days of the Year. One October morning, I look out the window and see rain pouring off the roof. A minute later, I look again. The air is filled with feathers. Snow? In late October? Around here, the first snow usually comes a month later. It typically melts upon landing and doesn't make a serious return until January. White Christmases, if memory serves, are a rarity, But this won't be a typical winter. This winter will be a bug slayer. It will be a winter to shiver every scrap of fat off the breast of a chickadee. It will be a winter that finds many a bachelor squirrel begging entry at the door of a girl's only dray, a gift of bedding clenched between his chattering teeth. In a couple of months, when my lawn's latitudes are tilted more steeply away from the sun, the snow will be made of fine crystals that baffle sound. But today's flakes are the size of Wheaties. Their crash landings in the grass make a sodden sizzle. With so many leaves still on the trees, it's an odd scene. Yawp and an adult crow are worming. Yawp hops into the air to snap at falling snowflakes. Then both crows retreat to the top of an apple tree. As their feathers dampen, they hop down a few branches to shelter under the foliage. That luxury won't last much longer. After an hour, the snow reverts to rain, and the menace of winter washes away. By afternoon, the insects have recovered from the warning. Gnats gyrate beside the deck, and Babette, the spider's front porch sister, has caught a fly. So what's up with this early snow? What indeed, replies weatherman Dave Santoro. It's nearly normal. Dave is chief meteorologist for the local CBS affiliate, WGME 13. He's the sort of weather guy who raises his substantial eyebrows in excitement when he identifies an advancing cold front. He leans into the camera to describe how condensing moisture releases heat to the atmosphere. Dave is, to quote Dave, a meteorb. That's a geek who's geeky over meteorology. This October is colder than normal, he tells me one frigid evening between broadcasts. Sometimes the prevailing winds just establish themselves and don't move. The jet stream can set up in a way that won't change for sometimes months. This proves prophetic. The cold snap will turn into a cold pounding that lasts 5 months. The snow picks up in late November with a series of half-inch dustings. For tracking animals, these are ideal. The mouse who hops across the deck in the night leaves an impression of every toenail. A crow, on takeoff, carves a feather fan in the snow. From a squirrel's paw print, I can guess the number of nickels in his pocket. But a day or two after each snowfall, the air warms, and the snow trickles away under the flattened grass and brown leaves. For too long, the ground is bare. Cold air seeps between grains of soil. Chilly rivulets of air trickle down wormholes and into the lairs of spiders. The cold sinks deeper into the earth every day. This is not supposed to happen. Sleeping roots and flower bulbs and worms and insects were counting on nature to tuck them under a white quilt. Fresh snow is nearly as protective as fiberglass insulation, keeping in the earth's heat. Snow, if I had some, would slow the penetration of cold air into the soil. The earth might freeze only 4 feet deep, instead of 5. The winter solstice comes, but still no snow. My breath rises into a hard, starry sky when I say goodnight to guests on the front steps. Finally, on Christmas, a storm plows across my yard. High above, water vapor has collected on circulating bits of desert dust, asteroid fragments, and forest fire ash. As wind pushed the clouds east, these ice cores grew into starry flakes. When the flakes were too heavy to ride the wind, they fell. Now, as they drop, a gale smashes them together. Their arms break off. Shards whisper against my storm windows. I can't see 20 feet to neighbor Hugh's house. West of here, in Albany, New York, the fragments are pouring down at 5 inches an hour. Even Texas is having a white Christmas. Under the heavy clouds, my yard is dark by mid-afternoon, and when we roll back into the sunlight, on Boxing Day, the lawn is under an 18-inch blanket. This is great for the subsurface folk. At least they've got some protection. But what will the above-grounders eat? Until last night, the mice could doodle over bare ground in search of seeds. The white-crowned sparrows could pick over the dry grasses. The crows could hammer at frozen pears and snag hardy flies from the air. I go out and feed the crows. The dog kibbles sink out of sight, but the crows come down from their begging branch on the oak tree anyway. Chest deep in snow, they stagger toward the food. Distracted by the fluff, they dip their heads and flutter, bathing. Squirrel Crook, whose tail bends in an L, hops past them, laboring to plow a path. The going will be easier in the coming days. The uppermost snowflakes will weld together, forming a crust that can support a crow or a squirrel. Then on New Year's Eve we'll get a storm much more typical to my yard. Air warmed by the Atlantic Ocean swirls up the East Coast, dumping rain. It freezes on contact with my cold world. Every branch grows a coat of ice. The deck railing is so slick that starlings come in for landing and slide right off the other side. They stumble like clowns. Out on the crusting snow, my crows skid sideways into little hollows. The young pines bend their needles to the ground. Up the coast a ways, people lose electricity. Pine branches, their needles clotted with ice, snap and gore roofs. Cars pirouette into the telephone poles. Yes, this is winter on the coast of Maine. Dave Santoro says the warm Gulf Stream out in the Atlantic contrasts with the cold continent and drives these sloppy storms up the eastern seaboard. I prefer the dry, cold storms that whistle in from the north. I imagine my animals do, too. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.